Hello, welcome to episode 33 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. Jay Maurice is everything you'd expect in a crypto anarchist hacker. When I had lunch with him before our interview, Jay kept his phone powered off and explained he wouldn't use a credit card, except maybe to pay for already tracked air travel. After our meal, he used his Trezor to sign a Bitcoin payment on his laptop via the cafe's Wi-Fi. There's nothing in particular Jay is trying to hide. He simply wants to live his life free from surveillance of his location and financial activities. You may have already heard of Jay. He was part of the WizSec team that analyzed the movement of funds that were stolen from Mt. Gox. He's also been called Roger Ver's go-to guy when it comes to personal defense from hackers. Many of his larger clients expect secrecy when they hire him, as they turn to Jay when they've been hacked. While Jay calls Tokyo his home, I spoke to him in Los Angeles as he was just finishing a several-month project here. Now here's Jay.
So you're a self-described crypto anarchist nomad hacker.
Yeah, I've been a freelance consultant for most of my career. I lived most of my life in Tokyo, but I've been traveling all over North America recently for different projects. And yeah, I'm basically like a nomad.
So you're a Bitcoin security specialist. I saw your title was chief hacking officer at WizSec.
Just for the record, I'm no longer affiliated with WizSec. This is a company that me and some of my friends formed originally for the purpose of investigating the failed Bitcoin exchange, Mt. Gox in Tokyo. We were all goxed. We were all former customers, and we wanted to figure out what happened, and we weren't getting any answers from the Japanese cyber police or from the bankruptcy trustee. And so we started our own little investigation, but soon it became the, I guess, authoritative report just de facto because nobody else released anything. And lots of mainstream media like Financial Times and CNBC were all covering our report, basically explaining how Mt. Gox was insolvent since day one. And I left the company, I guess, April of last year to kind of go back on my own as a freelance consultant. So I'm Wiz, but I'm no longer affiliated with WizSec. They're still running the company without me now.
Okay. I guess that was about the same time I saw that you guys published a whole thing about basically what your research had discovered. I found it really fascinating, so I'll put the link to it in the show notes.
The lead investigator of the Mt. Gox investigation now is my good friend Kim Nilsson in Tokyo, and he's been still working on that project after I've left the company. And I think he's released a report recently, and he might even be releasing another one soon, maybe. I'm not sure.
Did you meet Mark Karpeles?
Yeah, we met Mark several times. You know, we were working with him on the investigation at the time.
So you didn't meet him at meetups or anything before the investigation?
No, we didn't meet Mark until far after we were goxed. We were never his friends or anything like that.
Did you walk away with any kind of sense if it could have been an inside job? He'd had these Bitcoins somehow tucked away somewhere?
Well, we tried to remain as neutral as possible during the investigation, and we tried to interview all the former employees. We also analyzed the data a lot to get the real story of what happened. And, you know, a number of people I did speak to said many things about what Mark did in their, you know, what they witnessed. But I think the majority of the hack, the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin, were probably a third-party outsider hacker, right? You know, everybody knows that Mark purchased expensive things using the company funds. So it doesn't really make sense. You know, he had the opportunity to spend money however he wanted, and he did. So it doesn't really make sense that he would just steal hundreds of millions of dollars and bankrupt his own company. I genuinely believe he didn't really understand what had happened. Even at the very end, you know, he was still trying to figure it out.
Let's go back a little bit. What were you doing before you got into Bitcoin?
I had a security consulting company. We consulted for banks in the Japanese countryside. We would just go over there into their data centers and kind of pen test them and build their networks up to be more secure. It was a pretty cool little startup I had there. Once I got into Bitcoin, my partner at the time didn't want to be associated with Bitcoin because at that time it was when Mt. Gox was front page news in Japan, and everybody in Japan had a very negative association with Bitcoin. So I basically left that security consulting company to start WizSec, which became our Bitcoin security firm.
Well, let's go back even further then. How did you get into computers and code and all that stuff?
It all started when I was a kid. You know, I didn't have any siblings or too many friends at school, so I would just spend a lot of time on the computer. I kind of grew up on IRC, where a lot of very skilled actual hackers hung out on. And so I kind of grew up in that scene and learned how to use a Unix shell, learned how to write some code. I quit school when I was 14 to work at this internet provider in downtown Honolulu. And I learned how to be a network engineer and program routers and switches. And I think when I was 16 or 17, I got into more software development and working in data centers with lots of servers. And when I was 20, I moved to Tokyo and I became a freelance software consultant. And I also worked in Opera Software's Tokyo office when I was 23, porting all of their web browsers to the Japanese customers' TVs and Blu-ray players and Nintendo Wii and those types of devices. Then I went back on my own as a freelance consultant.
And so you've been freelance ever since?
Pretty much, yeah. I can't talk too much about some of the projects I worked on. But for example, if a bank did have some kind of intrusion, they would hire my former security consulting firm to kind of go in there, figure out what they got into exactly. And I would just write a report, kind of like what we did for Mt. Gox, but more like it was some random Vietnam hacker who got into some side system that wasn't a big deal, but they needed to investigate it properly for auditing and insurance reasons.
Can you explain to a layman like me kind of like how you do this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I guess the best way to investigate hacking incidents is just kind of think, if you are the hacker and you put yourself in their shoes, what would you try and attack? How would you get into the system? And you kind of look in those areas and see if they left any clues. And, you know, in the case of Mt. Gox, we were able to get portions of the database from various third parties, and that's how we did our analysis, right? In other cases, you don't have that kind of data to work with. You're really starting with whatever the hacker left behind. And usually they wipe all the logs and leave very few clues behind. But if you can find some other data somewhere, you can put together the story of what happened.
I saw on CoinDesk that when Roger Ver got hacked, you were basically the guy he turned to help him sort that out.
Roger and I had flown to Singapore together for this Bitcoin conference there that I think Brock Pierce was putting on, Coin Congress. And I was about to head over to his side of the hotel and we were going to go have dinner or something. And he sent me this message. He's like, oh no, all my stuff is hacked. You got to get over here right away. So I run over to his room and we start figuring out what the hackers have gotten access to. And we started to lock things down. In the meantime, you know, he's on Skype with the hacker trying to stall him and trying to get any information out of him that we can, while I'm on, you know, sitting right next to him, locking his domain names down and really just fighting with those guys to try and get the access back.
What were the hackers or the hacker, what did he want?
Basically, the hacker was first trying to hack into all of Roger's online accounts. When he had a little bit of trouble, he resorted to trying to extort Roger. He said he was going to ruin his life and steal his identity. And he had all these, you know, like an old copy of his U.S. passport. But I think at that time, Roger had already renounced his U.S. citizenship. So everything he was threatening Roger with was just kind of funny because it was all useless and no longer valid anyway.
Did you have to, I don't know, get into your ninja hacking skills to do much in that situation?
Yeah, actually, it was pretty intense because I would steal, you know, Roger's domain names back, and then the hacker would kind of steal them back. We went back and forth a few times before I had finally locked everything down. But fortunately, no Bitcoins were stolen, and there was no real damage or loss or anything. So the hacker didn't really have anything against him, and instead, Roger just put the bounty out on the hacker. After we had locked everything down and gotten everything, all the access back. That was around the time the Silk Road news came out, where I think DPR put a bounty out on somebody, you know, like to have him killed. And so I think this hacker, his name is Savaged, might have thought that Roger was going to put a bounty on him to be killed as well. I'm not really sure. Of course, the bounty was just to legitimately catch him.
Today's magic word is hacker. HACKER. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB Coin listener reward on letstalkbitcoin.com. You have 1 week from this episode's release to claim the magic word.
What do you feel is the safest way for non-technical people to use and store Bitcoin?
Personally, I just use a Trezor as my primary wallet. I think any hardware wallet that's been thoroughly vetted by the community is probably safe. Personally, I've used KeepKey. Ledger is also very nice. They have some really cool products coming out. But Trezor is like a nice small hardware wallet that you can just carry in your pocket all the time. Because it's a hardware security module, it can never really be hacked, right? The only risk is that somebody who sends you a Bitcoin address, their communications would be intercepted by a hacker and their Bitcoin address would be replaced by the hacker's Bitcoin address. So as long as you can do a secure key exchange or some other way to exchange that Bitcoin address in a secure way, then you'll probably be fine.
And I am going to mention you have a blinged out Trezor necklace. Was that custom made or?
Yeah, it's just, there's, you know, a lot of people wear gold jewelry, but I like Bitcoin jewelry, I think, is a up and coming fad, maybe.
I'm just curious, like, is there a certain like threshold dollar value or something where you will try to make sure the Bitcoin address you're paying to is definitely the Bitcoin address you're supposed to be paying to?
Yeah, I mean, if it's less than $100, if you're just paying at a restaurant or settling a bill with a friend or something small, it's not really a big deal to just scan their QR code and feel safe about it. If it's for any significant sum of money, you definitely want to have PGP signed emails to exchange the Bitcoin addresses or some other secure, you know, key exchange. And you want to use multi-sig transactions. So multiple people in your organization would have to sign off that they verified that the address is correct. Also, address whitelisting is a very popular technique to basically build a kind of like an address book of what address belongs to who. So when you do send the money back and forth, you've already done that secure key exchange and you make it very difficult to add new unknown Bitcoin addresses to your authorized senders list.
That's interesting. As you're saying that, I'm thinking of that BitPay issue where they mistakenly sent off like $1 million in Bitcoin, I guess. Are you familiar with that one?
Right. I think that's probably one of the largest attack vectors in Bitcoin is just replacing the Bitcoin address. A lot of people don't think about it. A lot of people don't call or verify the address through some other external way. So if you're going to send anybody any significant amount of money, just call them real quick and say, are you sure the address starts with 12345? And just triple check.
Well, maybe that's one of the simplest, most important Bitcoin security tips I've heard. So thanks for that. Getting out of the realm of Bitcoin, just do you have any general security recommendations for the average Joe?
Yeah, I guess security in general would just be don't install any software that hasn't been vetted by a lot of users. Make sure your software updates are, you know, all up to date. Don't log into your computer as administrative user. Just make like a normal user account for yourself and only use that administrative user when you really need it. If you use like an iPad Pro, like the one you've got, it's very unlikely that that's going to be hacked, right? Because it's a very locked down device where all your apps are really secure. Whereas the PC architecture is much more vulnerable to viruses where every software application has full access to the whole system. So just by kind of operating off of an iPad Pro or something like that, you're already inherently much more secure than using a PC. I mean, rule number one, just don't click on things in your email. Don't install software from people you don't trust. And even if you do trust them, you know, don't trust that software because it might have bugs. Don't run it with root or administrative privileges. There's a lot of things you can do to mitigate the risks. There's no real perfect security model. The only thing you can do is create a multi-layer security system and identify when a layer is compromised because you're always going to be compromised at some point. You just have to put your Bitcoin keys in the innermost layer and monitor so when the outer layers are compromised so you can detect it and take action at that point. Lock down the system before they compromise into any further layers up the stack, right?
What do you think about the idea of leaving plain text Bitcoin private keys with trivial amount of Bitcoin on various devices just to kind of see if that ever disappears? Is that stupid or do you think that that could be a helpful way to see if you've been maybe hacked?
That's an interesting honeypot or tripwire idea. But I think to a sophisticated attacker, they would check to see how much money is on that address or that private key. And if it's not what they're looking for, they'll wait. I've heard some stories where attackers wait 6 or 8 months or even a year, reading every email that somebody sends, waiting for them to do a very large Bitcoin transaction. And when they go to send the Bitcoin addresses to each other, that's when the hacker switches the address with their own address. And, you know, say it was a 1,000 Bitcoin transaction or something. If the hacker is very good, that time that they invested at monitoring all their emails for Bitcoin transactions would have really paid off if they just get that 1,000 Bitcoin transaction, whatever they were waiting for.
What do you think the average hacker is looking to do to a non-Bitcoin user?
Well, Bitcoin really changed the hacking world because it introduced this new concept of incentivized hacking. If you hack someone who has Bitcoins and you steal their money, then you're directly getting that money. And that's very different from how the world was before, where you would have to hack into an e-commerce site, get a whole bunch of credit card numbers, and then try to monetize those credit card numbers by ordering stuff to a mail drop or however they did it before. Now with Bitcoin, it's so easy. And that's why you see this ransomware, crypto locker type software that encrypts all your data and holds it hostage unless you send them Bitcoins, because the hackers want to use Bitcoin. It's a new way to get money out of people.
So we just had lunch and I got to see that you really do not like being tracked. We parked a car and you did not want to slide a credit card into the little credit card readers they have in LA on all the parking meters now. So you mentioned you like using Bitcoin, but you need to anonymize it. So I'm really curious, what do you think are the right ways to anonymize your Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think that's just the crypto anarchist in me. Whenever I have the chance, I'll always prefer to pay with cash or with anonymized Bitcoin, just on principle. I mean, just like how the NSA is monitoring everybody's data in the US, all of their web traffic and their emails and those kind of information, I don't feel that FinCEN or other parts of the US government should be snooping on financial transactions either. But for some reason, everybody seems to be united against the NSA monitoring web traffic, and nobody really seems to be protesting the monitoring of financial transactions, which I believe should be private as well.
Yeah, I can't argue with you, even if I'm not living that life.
Yeah, especially with Bitcoin now, we finally have the technology to send money to anybody at any time. And we also have the ability to make it private. So I don't think we should use credit cards anymore. I think obviously when everyone does accept Bitcoin directly, we just send them anonymous Bitcoin. It'll be just like paying with cash, right?
I can't help but think, especially in a few years with nation states, huge resources of computers and stuff, and the public blockchain. I mean, you have to go to some effort to not be, I guess, somewhat traceable, right?
Yeah, the blockchain obviously makes it very easy to track where money is going. But if you mix it with other wallets, this can really make things very difficult for them, which I believe is what we all should be doing. We shouldn't be making it easy for the government to spy on us by linking our debit card to our Metro card, to our Uber account, to everything. Because once they have one piece of personally identifiable information that's linked to all these other accounts, like your debit card or your credit card, then they can, if they want to prosecute you for some crime, they can just look at all of your financial transactions. They can look at everything you've done and put together a story why they should put you in jail. And for a lot of political dissidents, that's what they do. The worst is probably in China, where your credit rating is now tied to all of your friends on social media and everything. If you say anything, you know, critical of the government, or if your friends say anything critical of the government, your credit score goes way down. So it kind of discourages you from even, you know, socializing with other political dissidents.
Wow, I've never heard that. But I guess I'm still unclear, because, you know, I get some Bitcoin, say, on Coinbase. How do I remove the really clear trail to my wallet?
I think if you want to trade Bitcoin, the best way is probably peer-to-peer using local trader functionality in the Mycelium wallet or local Bitcoins. You're still exposing yourself, some of your personal information, to those services when you use them, but it's a lot less than giving your ID documents to Coinbase or basically just sending them everything, all of your transactions with rich metadata. Just make it difficult for people to spy on you, and I think that'll go a long way.
So now what if I'm just trying to buy Bitcoin when that price dropped a bit? Maybe some people have some limit orders in an exchange.
There's a few concerns when it comes to trading on the exchange. Obviously, you have to trust the exchange, not only with your money and your Bitcoins, but you also have to trust them with your personally identifiable information, your ID documents, and all of your trading transactions. So there's a lot of homework you need to do to determine which Bitcoin exchange you're going to trust. If you want to trust a US-based coin exchange, if you want to go to Europe or Asia, you have, might have more privacy going outside of the US, right? The US makes it, they kind of make everything easy for you. They want to seduce you into doing everything the easy way. Yeah, just connect your bank account to your Coinbase and they'll make it so easy for you to buy and sell Bitcoins. But it, that also makes it very easy for them to monitor your transactions. And I know some exchanges will actually let you trade anonymously. You just deposit Bitcoin on the exchange and you can trade whatever you want and then withdraw that Bitcoin. And you don't have to give your name or anything like that, which I think is pretty cool. There's better services out now. Like Zuko is working on this new service called Zcash, which is basically a fork of Bitcoin with zero knowledge.
Tell me what you know about Zcash, because I've seen it in the news lately, but I haven't researched it.
My understanding of Zcash, I remember seeing it 6 or 8 months ago, a quick demo of it, is you have the ability to send and receive Zcash coins like you do with Bitcoin every day, but you also have an additional feature in the wallet that allows you to convert Zcash into newly minted Zcash. And the network and the blockchain are designed in such a way that this can be done with zero knowledge. So supposedly the two transactions cannot be linked to each other. It's kind of like a Coinbase transaction where new Bitcoins are created. If you have 100 Zcash coins, you kind of dissolve those into the network and freshly newly minted Zcash coins will come out that are totally unlinkable to the original ones.
How do you feel about things like Dash or Monero or these other privacy-oriented cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, there's a lot of really cool altcoins out there that are working on the privacy problems, but I feel that until there's a really solid zero-knowledge coin implemented like Zcash, it's probably not going to take off. There's so many altcoins out there, and none of them have really gotten any traction at all. But if something like Zcash can take off, then we can probably see it first used on like the dark markets or maybe with privacy-oriented individuals who really want to stay private with their transactions.
So do you feel there's actually a technical advantage to Zcash the way you understand it?
Sure. If it's implemented correctly how they claim, then it's basically the dream of perfect privacy with digital currency transactions.
So something like Zcash, I mean, yeah, Bitcoin is not being banned or something, but I always wonder if that's kind of like just on the edge, and if a more privacy-oriented coin were to become major, if governments would react. I mean, what do you think?
Okay, right now criminals use cars for their crimes. They use cash for their crimes. They use the internet for their crimes, but none of those things are illegal. Why would Zcash suddenly be made illegal just because some bad people use it? You know, this is made for everyone to improve the lives of everybody in the whole world by making their transactions private and secure.
It's just a thought, because obviously there are, you know, people trying to ban phones that don't have a back door. You know, I mean, there's been a bill in New York and California trying to ban new phones that law enforcement can't get into. So I feel like there definitely are forces in the government that...
That's the thing, though. I mean, guns are illegal in a lot of parts of the world, too, but somehow terrorists still find guns, right?
Well, I do think they should make guns illegal for terrorists, but
But that's what I'm saying, is that these criminals or these terrorists are always going to be breaking the laws to get weapons, or if you make cryptography illegal... Do you really think the terrorists are going to say, oh, cryptography is illegal now? Okay, we won't use it then for our communications.
Well, sure. That's exactly the argument I'd make. But again, thinking from the government's perspective, if things get too secret, are they going to get pissed?
No, the problem is that the government thinks that they can ban cryptography, but it's just math. And there's so many free software implementations of cryptography out there. It's really a joke to imagine terrorists not using cryptographic software just because some government said it's illegal. I mean, they're terrorists. Why are they going to obey the law any more than any other criminal?
I agree. The government isn't always following perfect logic. Anyway, do you have feelings about the current block size limit debate, scaling Bitcoin, and Bitcoin governance?
Yeah, sure. Originally, we saw a lot of people suddenly take to the social media campaigns that we should raise the block size limit right now, you know, raise it to 8 megabytes, or even more aggressive plans that had it going up to the gigabytes within so many years. And I think a lot of these movements were kind of by people who didn't understand all the technical challenges that would be presented with such a large block size limit. Obviously, there's a lot of technical challenges that needs to be fixed before you can have 1 gigabyte blocks or even much smaller blocks than that. And all of those technical issues have to be addressed to really scale Bitcoin. You can't just, you know, throw a whole bunch of fuel into a nuclear reactor and expect it to scale well. I mean, it's going to blow up at some point if you just push it so hard. And so we have to be very, very careful about raising this block size limit. And a lot of the people who are really pushing for the aggressive increase of the block size limit, I feel, don't understand all the technical challenges on the table, right?
Mike Hearn, who's exited Bitcoin, obviously he's somewhat technically knowledgeable and adept. Why do you think he was pushing for that 8 megabyte XT version of Bitcoin?
It seems the reason why he forked Bitcoin and kind of went rogue like that against the core developers was, I guess, he wanted to, you know, take control of the Bitcoin client that a lot of people were using. Obviously, that didn't work out for him. I mean, there's a lot of political reasons that I don't really want to speculate on, but I think the Bitcoin core developers really do have the best interests of the network and the ecosystem at heart. And I think there's a lot of legitimate reasons why they just don't just increase the limit arbitrarily. I think there's a lot of improvements they want to make in the technology first before making such a drastic change like that. They're very right to be cautious and conservative about these types of limits that could really destroy Bitcoin if it's not properly done.
Do you have a specific idea how, say, a jump to 8 megabytes might hurt Bitcoin?
And I'm not even going to pretend to be an expert in, you know, block size limit debate, but I can think of many things just off the top of my head that we would have to address. I mean, considering the majority of mining is done in China right now, and they have the Great Firewall there, that's going to be limiting a lot of the blocks. And if those blocks are larger size, we're going to be seeing more orphan blocks, which kind of destabilizes the network in different ways. The disk space issue is one problem. The memory usage is another problem. I mean, a lot of nodes simply can't support that much, 8 megabytes blocks and or even that many transactions in their mempool right now. So a lot of people have to upgrade their hardware at the same time. It's going to be very interesting to see how full nodes as, you know, standalone hardware devices come to evolve and be part of the ecosystem, kind of like how we see miners all specialized equipment now. Maybe nodes will have to be specialized equipment soon in the near future.
I recently hired Joe Looney, one of the active developers in the Let's Talk Bitcoin ecosystem, to create some code that allows one to enter a Bitcoin amount and a date and get a US dollar value result. It's perhaps the easiest way to look up the US dollar value of a past Bitcoin transaction. If this sounds useful to you, give it a try at bitcoinhistoricprice.com. And please let me know if you have any feedback.
How do you feel Bitcoin in Japan differs from Bitcoin in USA or any other countries that you feel like you have a sense of?
Yeah, Bitcoin in Japan was very interesting because for the most part, the government didn't feel it was something that needed to be regulated. Most people in Japan had heard of Bitcoin after Mt. Gox was front page news. For the long time, people had heard about it, but they didn't really understand what it was or didn't have any interest in it. And now it's kind of coming back. You have a number of new exchanges in Japan that are very well venture backed and very well run, like Bitflyer and all these other new ones popping up that are very promising. They bring a lot of expertise. There's a lot of financial capital in Japan that people are willing to invest into Bitcoin. They're also very interested in the newer projects like Ethereum and Factum. And, you know, every week at the Tokyo Bitcoin meetup, it's so interesting to see all these new faces and hear what they want to do with Bitcoin or related cryptocurrency technologies. I guess it's now come around full circle to where Bitcoin is no longer this big evil thing, but it's back to something that people don't understand or don't have an opinion of too much. And that is really good because it gives them an open mind. They now understand that Bitcoin was not just one company in Tokyo that went bankrupt. It's this huge ecosystem of companies. And they now understand that the CEO of Bitcoin is not in jail. That was just one company. They're slowly learning. Hopefully the government doesn't regulate it too much, because Japan used to be probably one of the coolest places for Bitcoin where it was totally unregulated. If they do regulate it like they are in the US, which is probably going to happen, unfortunately, then, you know, it'll be subject to taxes. And that's probably like the worst thing the government can really do to Bitcoin is tax it to death. Because I think in Japan right now, the Bitcoin exchanges or dealers have to pay like 10% sales tax on Bitcoins or something crazy.
That seems bizarre.
Yeah, I don't think the government legislation is ever going to catch up to the new technology of Bitcoin. What's most likely going to happen is that Bitcoin will just become totally decentralized banking system, where if people want to pay taxes, then that's their choice. That's what I kind of feel it's going towards already, because right now there's still a lot of centralized Bitcoin exchanges like Coinbase. Once they're replaced with more decentralized or distributed systems where it's more peer-to-peer, you know, where you can trade Bitcoin with anybody, kind of like how with an Uber app, you know, anybody can be a taxi driver, then not as many people are going to be so worried about the government rules on Bitcoin, and they're just going to do how they naturally feel they should trade it.
Something about the idea of the Tokyo Bitcoin meetup sounds exciting. How long have you been part of that meetup?
At least a year, maybe 2 years now. I'm not really sure. It was started by Roger Ver many years ago. I think it was one of the oldest meetups, and lots of really cool people there.
Does Roger still come?
Yeah, I haven't seen him in quite a while, but I know he's still very active, yeah.
Do you have any interesting stories of different hacks you've seen in banks?
Typically, one of the tellers is compromised. You know, they have something on their network. I've seen some pretty cool stuff where this guy left some USB memory sticks on some table at the bank. And sure enough, one of the tellers plugged the USB memory stick into their computer and, you know, opened whatever documents were on there to kind of check it out. I mean, it kind of makes sense. If you leave enough of those USB sticks lying around every bank branch, then eventually someone's going to plug it in and see what's on there. There's also, you know, just traditional hacks into the system through APIs or whatever they find. It's always very proprietary. Most banking systems are custom written, so the attacks are also custom to match for that network as well. But the thing about a bank is that even if the bank network is compromised, it's nothing compared to the risk of running bitcoins. If they get your private keys, they've stolen the money. It's just amazing how little the bank really has to worry about, because at the end of the day, they're insured, at least up to their limits for each depositor, right? So it's not going to be an unrecoverable loss for the bank like it can easily be for a Bitcoin exchange like Mt. Gox or Cripsy.
You have any predictions on where Bitcoin will be a year from now?
Probably more retail merchants accepting it. Probably a lot more wallets that are easier to use for the average user. Probably more decentralization and distribution in the sense of exchanges. You're probably going to see more peer-to-peer, like local Bitcoins or Mycelium local trader, or even more like the Uber type system where it's just totally decentralized and you don't need to send your money to Coinbase and send your ID documents to Coinbase. You just meet someone or they come to you, kind of like when you call an Uber, and then you trade Bitcoin with them and that's it. Maybe you have a reputation system, but for the most part, it's pseudonymous, right? That's where I see it kind of heading in the next year or two.
Is there anything you think might take Bitcoin down?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of things that could mess up Bitcoin. I mean, people are always trying to attack the network. The government's trying to mess it up. They're trying to regulate it or tax it or control it in some way or just ban it completely. There's the mass media doing a good job of, you know, spreading all these stories how Bitcoin is dead or Bitcoin is evil. And then there's all these technical ways where bugs in the system could bring down Bitcoin pretty bad, or the political drama right now that's going on. There's some kind of hard fork. There's all kinds of things that could take down Bitcoin. But so far it's been very resilient, so hopefully it just keeps on getting stronger and stronger.
You tend to feel avoiding a hard fork is a preferable way to go?
Well, I think it's unavoidable that we're going to have to raise the block size limit and probably other things that require hard forks from time to time. It's just, this is the first hard fork where there hasn't been unanimous consent pretty much, right? I mean, I think there was a few in the past where nobody really said anything and they forked the network, but this is the first one where there's quite a bit of debate and they've had to have several conferences just to discuss this. So hopefully we can move on and get a better structure for making these kind of decisions. Unfortunately, that's just the nature of Bitcoin because it's not a dictatorship and it's totally decentralized. You're going to have much more political drama because everybody has their opinion and there's no management structure or anything really to the project. It's just totally, it's anarchy, right? It's pure anarchy.
Do you feel the kind of centralization of mining pool operators and how much mining is going on in China is an issue?
No, because I think the price is probably going to start rising again soon, and then you'll see more mining operators come online, which will make the mining more distributed. It's funny how centralized or decentralized the mining is heavily determined by the price of Bitcoin. So I think we'll see that change quite a bit as it has in the past. I remember it was a lot more centralized than it was now. There was one operator with over 50% of the entire hash rate, and now it's much more distributed. So I think it'll become even more distributed in the future.
What do you think of it as a consumer technology versus kind of like a back-end technology?
Well, when you use Facebook or Twitter, you're actually using a lot of underlying technologies, you know, cryptography to encrypt the HTTP traffic that goes over the TCP/IP packets that goes over the Wi-Fi. And when you're uploading your photo of your cat or whatever you're sharing to Facebook, you don't think about or even realize that you're using any of these underlying technologies. And that's probably what Bitcoin is going to become, is an underlying technology. You know, until this point, the internet has only had documents and images and text and video, but now it has money as its app. And this is going to change the world much more than Wikipedia or Google has so far, right? It's because this is going to connect everyone for the first time to where they can directly transact with each other without having to go through these centralized third parties. And that's just going to make the world so much more efficient and less government, you know, interference and regulation. It's just, we really have to see what Bitcoin is going to become, just like how in the early 90s, it wasn't really clear how the internet was going to develop.
If people are interested in knowing more about you or hiring you or contacting you, where should they go?
I guess they could just follow me on Twitter. My username is pretty easy to remember. It's just WIZ, Wiz on Twitter. Or they can email me, j@wiz.biz, WIZ.biz. I'm a freelance consultant and have a lot of experience with security, network engineering, software engineering. Very happy to work with anyone.
Thanks so much for taking the time.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed episode 33 of The Bitcoin Game with guest Jay Maurice. Please check the show notes page for links to various topics discussed in this episode or to comment on the show. You'll find all episodes of The Bitcoin Game at thebitcoingame.com. And if you listen to the show, please say hi to me on Twitter at TheBTCGame. See you next time.